The title of my shiur is Can We Prove That God Exists and He Gave the Torah to Moshe at Sinai? If yes, then why doesn't everyone believe? And if not, then why do we believe? I think that this is a question that some of us do not want to ask, but maybe we are afraid because maybe we are afraid of what the answer will be. But it is a question that we should all be asking. As Orthodox Jews, we spend our lives doing a lot of difficult and challenging things, and the question is why? Now, maybe the answer is that we follow all this halacha because of social orthodoxy. We're doing it because that's how we've been brought up. It creates a fringe benefit, like being part of a community, and that's how we do it. And I hear that argument. However, that argument is very unsatisfying to me to live my whole life and follow these unusual rituals simply because we want to be part of a community. It makes my religious life, which is such a central part of my life, so unmeaningful. I would hope that I believe in what I'm doing, that there is value to what I'm doing. And today I would like to ask why I do what I do. What is the basis for my religious practice? Ultimately, I engage in religious practice based on our Torah Shebaal Peh, our oral tradition, because I believe that God created the world and is involved in the day-to-day affairs of the world. And there was a revelation at Sinai when God communicated that he would tell Moshe the Torah and the mitzvot, and what we have in this Torah is a true and accurate representation of the events of our history. Believing in this is also the basis of Torah Shebaal Peh and religious practice that we engage in today. So I want to know whether we can prove these assumptions upon which my faith is based, that God created and runs the world, and that the Sinai revelation is true. And if it's true, then why do so many people not believe that it's true? So first, what I first want to do is I actually want to rephrase my goal that is reflected in the title. After all, how do you prove that something is true? There are a lot of sophisticated thinkers who talk about what is truth, how do we know when we arrive at the truth, and how do we achieve truth about God who is beyond our understanding? So for me, I would like to change my question a little bit. And I think that when we talk about these issues, when we ask these questions, what we really should ask is the following: whether the arguments for the existence of God and the revelation at Sinai are more compelling than other alternative explanations, such that they would convince me to live a completely Torah observant lifestyle. For me, it's not about proving yes or no or proving more likely than not. It's about whether the evidence is compelling enough to convince me to live a completely Torah observant lifestyle. Now, I would like to make two introductory points. First, I believe that there is compelling evidence to convince me to live a completely Torah observant lifestyle, but I still believe that a leap of faith is required. First of all, miracles and prophecy might not even convince us to believe in God. We are a stiff-necked nation, and we demonstrate in the Torah that no matter how many miracles God has performed for us, we still rebelled against God. So therefore, even without a leap of faith, even if things were 100% clear, we can also, and we have, come up with alternative explanations for the evidence. We could also find ways to rebel against God. But I think there's another reason why a leap of faith is required. In his book, Reason to Believe, Rabbi Chaim Jachter provided a suggestion as to why a leap of faith is required. He explained that one of our relationships with God is like a chassid and a kala, a bride and a groom. That is our relationship that is highlighted in Shir HaShirim. A relationship of marriage is only successful if each side actively decides to choose to commit to the other. If God would reveal himself completely, then that would not be a real relationship, as we would be compelled to enter that relationship. Therefore, God made it possible for us to discover him, but it is not automatic. It requires work on our part. Now, my second introductory point is that I'm going to share with you my own personal reasons why I believe in the existence of God and the Sinai revelation. I will share with you three categories of evidence that are brought that point to the existence of God and or the sign of revelation. Now, some of these arguments are more compelling and some are less compelling to me personally. So I'm first going to present all of the evidence, and then I will share with you which piece of evidence mostly resonate with me and why. And that being said, I believe that the evidence in the aggregate is compelling for me. Others may disagree with specific pieces of evidence, but my goal really is to share all of the information and the different categories of evidence, and then to share with you what personally resonates with me, so that if someone were to ask you or stop you on the street and ask you, why do you believe in God and the sign of revelation, hopefully you can articulate what evidence is compelling to you. And as we will see, I think different people may find different types of evidence more meaningful than others. I think that we can divide up the evidence into three different categories. First, evidence from the existence and nature of the world. Second, evidence from Jewish history. And three, evidence from the Torah and religious experience. Now, regarding the first category, the existence and nature of the world, I like to call that there's 1A and 1B. I think there are two general arguments within this category. One is the existence of the world, and one is the nature of the world. Regarding the existence of the world, what some refer to as the cosmological argument is that God must exist because the physical universe exists. Rav Sadia Gaon, Rabbeinu Bachya established that everything in the world was created and nothing can create itself, and there cannot be an infinite chain of objects that can create one another. So there must have been some first cause that created everything in the universe, and that first cause is God. The Rambam has a similar argument in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Gimel, that he writes that all movement must be caused by some force. So there must be a prime mover who moved the highest sphere, which ultimately moved other spheres, which eventually move physical objects, and that prime mover must be God. I think a modern-day version of this argument relates to the Big Bang Theory, which is the emergence of the universe from a state of extremely high temperature and density that occurred billions of years ago. Now, science can explain how the universe began as just a single point and then expanded and stretched to grow as large as it is right now, but science cannot explain how that first point came to be, and that's where God comes in. So that's the first argument, what I like to call 1A from the existence of the world, that there must have been something that created the world. Nothing can be created by itself, and science can explain everything except for what caused that first Big Bang, as it were. The other argument, 1B, is not the existence of the world, but the intricate nature of the world. And Rav Bachya Ibn Pakuda writes in Chovos HaLevavos, in Shar Beis, the Shar Bechina, that examination of the world will make a believer out of you. The Rambam in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, Perek Beis, Halacha Aleph and Beis, writes that the more that we understand the intricacies and the wisdom of the world, the more that we will love God. Rav Elchanan Wasserman in his Kovetz Ma'amarim states that it is obvious that there is a God from the fact that we see order in this world. Common sense teaches us that this is impossible to happen by itself, and thus it is obvious that the world has a creator. This is what is known as the argument from design, or the inkwell argument, that if I were to show you a written essay and claim that I accidentally knocked over a bottle of ink and it spilled in this particular pattern, you would certainly call me a liar, because intelligent writing could not be formed by coincidence. Likewise, there is no merit to the claim that the earth which is much more intricate and complex than one sheet of writing, was formed without a creator. The entire universe is so amazingly well designed that it could not have turned out this way if it were not designed purposefully by an intelligent creator. Just as the intricate design of a watch proves that it was created by an intelligent watchmaker for the purpose of telling time, so too the world must have been created purposefully. And it's called telos in Greek, means purpose by an intelligent designer, and the designer is God. So that's a teleological argument for God. Now, Professor Nathan Aviezer, he wrote a book called Fossils in Faith, Understanding the Torah and Science. And he provides a modern day example of this argument when he writes about the anthropic principle that very slight changes in the laws of nature would have made it impossible for life to exist. And human life would not have been possible were not for the occurrence in the past of a large number of highly improbable events. He writes that if the nuclear force were only a few percent weaker, there would be no solar fuel. And if the nuclear force were only a few percent stronger, then the sun would explode. He writes that after the planets were formed, they all had large amounts of surface water, and the three planets of Earth, Venus, and Mars, they all had large amounts of surface water. The deep channels, he writes, that are observed today on the surface of Mars were carved out long ago by the copious, fast-flowing Martian primordial surface water. Similarly, Venus was once covered by deep oceans that contained the equivalent of a layer of water 3 kilometers deep over its entire surface. However, in the course of time, all surface waters on Mars and Venus disappeared. So the question is, how did Earth escape this catastrophe? And he writes that the Earth just happens to be sufficiently distant from the sun that our surface water neither evaporated nor decomposed as happened on Venus. Moreover, the Earth just happens to be sufficiently close to the sun that the temperature remains high enough to prevent the oceans from freezing permanently as happened on Mars. And again, this is very unusual in terms of the likelihood of this happening is very, very low, very improbable. And he writes the same thing in terms of the atmosphere, that there's a delicate balance about the atmosphere. And so basically he takes the view that the intricate details and the improbable events that have led the Earth to be able to sustain life are so improbable that it's miraculous, it's supernatural, it has to have come from God. Now, Rav Elchanan Wasserman takes this inkwell argument one step further. And he argues that if there is a God, given the high degree of order in the world, then it is obvious that God, in other words, if there's an intelligent designer, then it is obvious that God would provide a manual on how to function in the world that he created, and he would communicate his will to the intelligent beings that he created. There's a quote from Professor Joshua Golding in his essay, Commitment to Judaism in the Modern Era, in the book Strauss, Spinoza, and Sinai, where he writes, "If it is rational to believe in a supreme person who is both all-powerful and all-good, it is also rational to expect that the supreme person would take an interest in guiding the affairs of human beings toward the best possible moral and spiritual end. Moreover, insofar as the supreme person is capable of communication with human beings, it is rational to expect that, sooner or later, the supreme person would communicate with human beings through prophecy and revelation." Now, that is the first category of evidence. A second category of evidence is Jewish history. And again, I would like to break this category into two, 2A and 2B. There are two broad arguments. The first is the mass revelation or the Kuzari principle. And the second is the unique history of the Jewish people. The Kuzari principle is explicated in a number of places in the Kuzari, a philosophical work written by Rav Yehuda HaLevi in the 12th century. The Ramban, by the way, also subscribes to this approach. And he writes about this actually in this past week's Parsha, Parsha Veschanan, Perek Dal, Pasuk Tes, where he writes that the story of mass revelation at Sinai will convince us today that the events happen. Why? Why will we believe that? Rabbi Asaf Ben Narsh wrote, I'm just going to quote you what he wrote in an essay about belief in God. And he writes the following: "Some contemporary thinkers, based on a few sentences in Sefer Kuzari, argue that while there is no philosophical proof of the truth of our belief, there is a historical proof. They argue that a tradition of mass revelation cannot possibly be a fabrication. No one could have convinced an entire nation that they experienced a revelation at Sinai if they had not. And no one could convince an entire nation to teach their children that there had once been a revelation at Sinai if that generation did not honestly believe that such a tradition had been passed on to them by their forefathers. Therefore, if millions of contemporary Jews sincerely believe in the Sinaitic revelation, then the previous generation must have likewise sincerely believed in it, and so too all the way back to the generation who lived at the time of that revelation. If the Jews alive then believe that they themselves witnessed the revelation of the Torah at Sinai, then they must have indeed witnessed it, in which case not only God's existence, but also the divine origin of the Torah is a proven fact. The Rabbi Kellerman, Larry Lawrence Kellerman, Rabbi David Gottlieb are two Kiruv professionals that they have written extensively on this argument. Rabbi Kellerman said that if the Sinai experience did not happen then, and it was all made up, and how could someone at some point convince an entire group of people that they all had national amnesia about an experience that happened to 3 million people? There is no record ever of national amnesia. There's also no record of anyone coming along and convincing a large group of people about a new historical event that happened to that nation. In fact, Judaism is a religion that highly respects truth-telling and honesty, and when it seems counterintuitive to suppose that a tradition that so highly values truth-telling would be the result of a massive fabrication. And that is the Kuzari principle. But there is another argument from Jewish history, and that is Jewish history itself. The existence of the Jewish people defies history. And two individuals who lived around the same time make the same point. Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan, and Mark Twain. The Aruch HaShulchan and Aruch Chaim Siman Aleph, Seif Yud, writes essentially that the explanation of that, he writes that God punished us, or that we have had troubles throughout the years in exile, and that's because God needed to punish us. But he writes the following in the context of this halacha where he describes the exile. He says that the explanation of that which is written, to believe with a total belief that all of our troubles and all of our being jolted, is not on the path of revenge, God forbid, but rather to refine us. And that's why we've suffered throughout the years. If not so, we would not have any remainders over the course of the many centuries. And there is no sign or great wonder from this that we have stood such for such a long period of time as this. And this is the reason, the fact that we're still alive today. So this is obviously a sign for God. He writes, "For this is only the supervision of the Almighty over us that has not disappeared, nor will disappear for even one moment, like a father who supervises his only son and agonizes him for his benefit." And there's the Aruch HaShulchan is saying that the fact that we're still alive after all this suffering proves that that we're still in existence, prove that there is a God. Mark Twain, also in his famous essay concerning the Jews in 1899, he writes, "The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high to a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, but the Jew, all other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?" We defy normal historical rules. Nobody lives like the ancient Persians, Greeks, Egyptians, Spartans, Mongols, or Romans. But we are the only nation with an unbroken chain of transmission that links us back thousands of years, our survival attests to God's hashgacha over us. The longevity of our survival under horrendous conditions, the uniqueness of anti-Semitism, and our staggering contribution to mankind seems supernatural. The history of the Jewish people is a relentlessly persecuted people who managed not only to survive centuries of humiliation, but to emerge as a strengthened and influential nation. The history of the Jewish people is that we have constantly escaped destruction time and time again to build a thriving homeland. The creation of the State of Israel is highly improbable. The Six-Day War military victory and return to Jerusalem is highly improbable. And to top it all off, there are prophecies in the Torah that predict these highly improbable outcomes. In the Torah, God tells us that we are an eternal nation. In the Torah, God tells us that we will be exiled and we will return. In the Torah, God tells us that we are a nation that lives alone, that is unique. In the Torah, we are told that we will bring a blessing to the world. In the Torah, God tells us that we will remain small, but we will remain. We defy history in a highly improbable way. And the Torah makes these highly improbable predictions. The third category of evidence is the Torah and religious experience. So Rav Soloveitchik in Halachic Man writes the following: we require neither miracles nor wonders to prove the existence of God, for the halacha itself bears witness to its creator. I think what he means by that is that the intellectual beauty and strength of Torah is compelling. The Torah is a monumental work which is historically unique. The narrative story of Tanakh and the subsequent history of the Jewish people to this very day purports to be a record spanning thousands of years in which God interacts with prophets and the people of Israel. The Torah is a vast, all-encompassing, and complex system of law which covers nearly every aspect of life: legal, philosophical, ethical, and mystical. What other legal tradition compares in terms of history and vastness with a continuous chain of intellectual giants? If the tradition is that impressive, there has to be something to it. If we study halacha, then it must have come from a divine origin, because it is a recipe for a tremendously meaningful life in all of its complexity. Additionally, and that's sort of 3A, the Torah. Additionally, it's not just halacha, but religious experience, which is what makes us a believer. Rav Soloveitchik, and I'm going to read to you a quote from Rabbi Asaf Ben Arsh again, where he writes about the belief in God. He summarizes Rabbi Soloveitchik's view on this very beautifully. When he writes, Rabbi Soloveitchik offers a different understanding of the basis of faith. He explains that authentic faith is based on our experience of the divine. He therefore rejects the cosmological proof of God, viewing it as a mere corruption of an authentic cosmic experience. According to Rabbi Soloveitchik, a Jew once looked at the heavens and earth and saw the wondrous power and intricate wisdom of God, and then the philosophers turned it into a logical argument, demonstrating the existence of an abstract notion called God. He paraphrases Kierkegaard's sarcastic criticism of Anselm of Canterbury, who spent many days in prayer and supplication that he be vouchsafed a rational proof of God's existence. Does a loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? So too must the prayer for a soul clinging in powerful love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? According to Rav Soloveitchik, one experiences God's existence by talking to him in prayer, by hearing him speak in the voice of the Torah, and by seeing his fingerprints in the intricate beauty and majestic grandeur of the created world. An authentic belief which constitutes part of the fabric of one's existence can only emerge from one's experience and existential reality. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in a famous essay that he wrote in Jewish Action, called The Source of Faith is Faith Itself, he writes the following: without question, during my formative years and to a lesser extent beyond, the source and bulwark of my commitment was not so much a cluster of abstract factors or arguments as key persons. This may make my response less valuable for readers who have no access to my sources of strength and inspiration? I refer, of course, to those who, in the words of the Mishnah, put me on the path to temporal and eternal life, my parents, who were also my primary teachers, and my Rebbeim, of whom three, Rav Hutner, the Rav, and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, stand out far above the rest. At home, I received trust and strength, imbibed a work ethic, and initially breathed an atmosphere within which a balance between criticism and rootedness was constantly maintained. Both my parents, each in his own way, habitually raised serious questions about the religious world or about various textual philosophic aspects of the Torah, but always radiated a sense of profoundly engaged commitment. The greatest sources of faith, however, has been the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. At the level of rational demonstration, this is, of course, patently circular. I hold no brief for Anselm's ontological proof, and I recognize the theoretical possibility of self-delusion long before I ever heard of Feuerbach. Existentially, however, nothing has been more authentic than the encounter with Avinu Malkeinu, the source and ground of all being, nothing more sustaining, nothing more strengthening, nothing more vivifying. Encounter, of course, has been varied in part. It has been channeled primarily through Talmud Torah, but also through tefillah and the performance of mitzvos, or, if you will, by the halachic regimen in its totality. In part, it has been random moments of illumination while getting on a crowded bus or watching children play in a park at twilight. Obviously, it has also been greatly varied in intensity. In its totality, however, whatever the form and content, it has been the ultimate basis of spiritual life. Both intellectual giants like Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Lichtenstein assert that these feelings, these religious experiences, are real. Again, one can argue maybe they're only psychological, but these intellectual giants, among many others, believe that these feelings of a relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, this religious experience, is real. Additionally, sources of faith could include teachers who serve as a great inspiration for our belief in God and His Torah. The moral perfections that we see in our teachers through Torah, their remarkable character development, pointing to the unmistakable truth and divinity of Torah. So what I have shared with you are three categories of evidence as to the existence of God and or the Sinai revelation to the Jewish nation, which is the basis for the oral tradition and Orthodox practice today. The first, the existence and the nature of the world. The second, Jewish history, the proof from the mass revelation and the fact that our existence as Jewish nation defies history and many of the improbable aspects of the existence of the Jewish nation were foretold in the Torah. And three, the nature of Torah, the awesome nature and the depth and the breadth of the Torah and religious experience. For me personally, I understand the scientific evidence and the Kuzari principle, and they make sense to me. I'm also aware that some philosophers and scientists have challenged these proofs, and being that I'm neither a scientist nor a philosopher, I don't feel fully equipped to adequately respond to some of these challenges. So for me personally, the existence of the Jewish people that has defined Jewish history and our contributions to society and the many improbable predictions about our history that have been predicted in the Torah resonate with me. Additionally, the depth and the breadth of Torah, the belief that the Torah is a recipe to a more meaningful life, the fact that traditional Judaism has stood the test of time, and the religious experience that I have felt, and the fact that intellectual giants like Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Lichtenstein, and some of my Rebbeim have felt, make the experience real to me. This is why the evidence is compelling enough to convince me to live a completely Torah-observant lifestyle. Because I am working with these assumptions about the reality of God and the divine origin of the Torah. But maybe other people feel differently. Maybe they're not compelled enough by some of the arguments to the extent that it should lead them to change their lifestyle. Maybe they were not exposed to or inspired to some of the Rabbeim that I have been exposed to, nor do they appreciate the uniqueness of the Torah like I do. Again, I'm not saying that from a judgmental perspective. I'm just saying that might just be the reality. Nor may they value moments of religious experience like I do. I think that this can explain why I, and many listeners to this tape, to this recording, to this year, may find our basis for Torah observance so compelling, while others may not. And I will leave you all with one thought. For those who may not find Torah observance so compelling because you may struggle with the assumptions upon which our Torah observance is based, or are based, my recommendation is first to think about some of these scientific and historical pieces of evidence that I've shared today, and perhaps more importantly, take the plunge and immerse yourself in Judaism, in authentic Judaism. Experience Torah and mitzvot meaningfully, and hopefully while doing so, you may encounter God.